This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein speaks with a third-generation Mississippi Gulf ferryman about the ongoing destruction of his way of life as the BP Gulf Gusher continues to wreak havoc on coastal communities. Plus, the people in Oakland, California react to the verdict in the Oscar Grant case. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we continue our coverage of the Gulf oil disaster. I guess it's an underground earthquake or volcano that they can't seem to check. Millions of gallons are still going into the Gulf every day, and the people who live in and around the area and work on the Gulf of Mexico are very troubled about what's going on. On June 27th, the tragedy came home as oil hit the Barrier Islands in Mississippi and struck shorelines and injured birds, dozens of them. And there, watching it all happen, was Captain Louis Scrametta. He is the chief executive of the Ship Island Excursions in Gulfport. For three generations, his family has run concessions and ferried tourists and VIPs out to the lush Barrier Islands off the coast of Gulfport, Mississippi. And Mr. Scrametta, it is good to have you with us. We are sorry for the tragedy.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And the Barrier Islands down here are a wonderful place. You hit it right on the head there. It's tragic.
Tell us about your family history and the work that you do and what's been going on for generations in your family.
Yeah, we are the official concessioner for Gulf Islands National Seashore. Every national park has private enterprises, and you have a concession contract to operate services, whether it be food service, hotels, transportation. We are the official ferry service that brings the folks out to West Ship Island, which is within the National Seashore, one of the islands. And it's home to an old brick fortification built just before the Civil War. So it's very popular, has been very popular with tourists dating back to the 1930s. My grandfather started running the boat to the island in 1933. So that's how long we've been involved with the service. We received a Park Service contract in 1971 when the National Park Service took over the Mississippi Islands, and we've been able to maintain that contract all this time.
Let me just ask you, what was going through your mind on the 27th as you knew, as everybody was finally admitted, as your government finally admitted it, that Mississippi was in imminent danger, was in real trouble, the oil was coming? What was going through your mind?
Well, you just heard a helicopter fly over. I live on the beach, and you just heard a helicopter go by looking for oil. And I was one of the few people, one of the few voices of reason. I hate to brag, but I was worried about this at the outset. I knew when BP started telling people that they had capped the well, and then they started leaking again, and then it was 1,000 barrels a day, and then NOAA came in and said, no, this is 5,000 barrels a day. I knew we were in trouble. And, you know, working with the National Park Service and all these years, one of my greatest fears was an oil rig leaking oil and washing up on our islands, but they were always far enough away where it didn't happen, but there was, that, you know, the specter of that was always out there, and I worried about that for years, and I have been an advocate of keeping oil and gas drilling as far away from Mississippi as possible, and it was like my worst nightmare appearing, you know, it was surreal, really. I mean, we've been lucky here in Mississippi because we were the last coastline to get hit. And, of course, I knew it was coming. It was inevitable. We had a southwest wind blowing for 70-plus days, and then that Hurricane Alex came through last week, and that's what changed the wind to the southeast, and right away, boom, oil all over Ship Island Beach, West Ship Island, where we go, and Horn Island and Petit Bois Island. But, yeah, I went out there The rumors started coming through. I got a call from the chief of maintenance with the National Park Service. We had shut the operation down for a couple of days because the weather was pretty rough when the hurricane went through. It kicked up seas here in this region, and we canceled trips for a couple of days. But I got a call Thursday morning last week from the chief of maintenance to tell me that there was oil all around the lifeguarded swim area. All of our beach chair and umbrellas had oil, spots of oil on the ground. It wasn't a blanket of oil. It was just those spots of oil, like on the back of a leopard, you know, all over the white sand beach, that natural, beautiful beach of the island that's so famous out there. So I decided to run out there with just myself, my wife, my son, a couple of crew members, my brother. We cranked up the 105-foot, 300-passenger ferry boat. We decided to crank it up and go on out, even though the weather was rough. We just made a speed run out there just to investigate, check it out. First thing we saw when we tied up at the dock on the north side of the island was these pieces of taffy-like material, as big as your fist and bigger, and floating in the water near the water's edge. And the fish were swimming around it, and there we could see this material in the water. And that, of course, got our attention. Then I looked down to the east about 50 yards, and I could see a pitiful sight. It was a pelican that was solid black, just standing there. All you could see were those white eyes, you know, looking down with its beak down on its breast, just standing there. Well, I mean, I was shocked by that, of course. My wife immediately wanted to run over there and capture the critter and try to bring it in. And I said, nope, stop, just hold up. Let's just wait. Let's go across to the Gulf Beach, which was, you know, it's only about a half a mile walk across to the other side of the island. The island's not real wide. And then we got over there and we saw the oil everywhere. And then I was just disgusted about it and realized what was happening. There were seagulls and some other wildlife, other birds that had been oiled and were there just barely alive. And right away we called in, and the 800 number that BP gives you, it's calling for wildlife. And a woman said, yeah, we'll be right on it. So then a few minutes later, the park rangers arrived, and they told us the same thing that they had, you know, we asked about the bird, and they had called it in too. And then, of course, you know the news, it took 2 days for BP's wildlife people to finally get out there and get to rescue those animals. But the whole thing,
it took 2 days after you made the call for them to get out there and carry out the rescue. Was that an indication that they really didn't have a structure to rescue the animals?
They were totally unprepared. I can't tell you how many times I've seen this happen down here over the past 70-plus days. The cleanup effort is out of an operation in Mobile, Alabama. They call it the Unified Command. And they bring people in from all over the country, and it's like a war, you know, command and control center, a war room. And you have all these experts and all these people in there, and they have all these, you know, soldiers are giving orders to, but nothing's getting done. I mean, it's crazy. BP is spending a fortune, and they're telling you that we've got 20,000 boats that we've hired. Well, they don't tell you that they've hired every little boat with an outboard motor that's riding around in circles in the Mississippi Sound, doing nothing, spotting oil, they say. I mean, it's called their vessel of opportunity. It's outrageous. I mean, they're spending millions on these people. They're paying these people $1,500 a day and plus $300, I think, for a captain. And it's a ride around and look for oil. And they've got helicopters right overhead that can do everything that these boats are doing. But it's, like I say, it's a symbolic thing.
I followed this story about the birds. And one of your local environmental agency people came out after it was reported by a colleague of yours, Louis Miller, at the State Sierra Club. And the local environmental agency person said that, yes, there was a problem with the dispatch in terms of BP in Houston, where those calls went to. They've gotten rid of that dispatcher, and now the new dispatchers have been briefed, and they know what's going on. Were you satisfied with that?
Well, I was. The National Park Service was embarrassed by this whole episode. I mean, they were totally dependent on BP and the fish and wildlife people and their assigned wildlife rescue teams. They sat there for 2 days really angry because I know these guys. I know these Park Service folks are very dedicated people. And they said, we are just, you know, outraged by this. We were told they were coming any minute. A boat would be there. It never came. And then, you know, it made the news. A local reporter went out on the boat with us and filmed the tarball on the beach and then found these oiled birds. And it was a sensation here locally. I mean, people thought, were just shocked by it, outraged. And the film made it all the way up to the White House, I understand. The Sierra Club passed it on to the heads of the Park Service and various individuals. This was on a Friday now that we took passengers. We went out on Thursday, saw the birds. We took passengers out on Friday. The public saw the bird. The news hit the Friday night on the evening news. The next day, Saturday, you had wildlife people, dozens of them, all over the island looking for birds. Apparently that word came down from somewhere, I assume the White House, but they got their rear ends out there and started going to work. And reacting finally. But you know, if it wasn't for us taking day trippers out to the island, nobody would have ever done anything for these birds.
All right.
And you have to wonder now what's happening on the other barrier islands in Mississippi and Louisiana where you don't have access to them. How many birds are sitting there, you know, dying, and only because of the public, you know, outcry, they took care of them the birds on the islands, on Ship Island. So I'm wondering, what about Cat Island? What about the islands in Louisiana along the Mississippi coast, Louisiana border? There's a series of marsh islands. By the way, I guess you heard the oil is starting to move into eastern Louisiana, into Lake Pontchartrain, through the area called the Rigolets. It's a tidal wetlands marsh area in south eastern Louisiana, and it's the back door to New Orleans, and oil is moving as we speak, moving into Lake Pontchartrain near Slidell, Louisiana, which is just, people are just freaking out over this as well. I mean, people in New Orleans now are being affected by it. Not just South Louisiana near Grand Isle on the Gulf. Now the city of New Orleans itself, the lakefront, Lake Pontchartrain, the New Orleans lakefront is showing signs of oil.
And, wow.
They can't seem to stop it. I mean, that's the thing about this. Had they got out there after this thing started, they should have been out there with these skimmer boats, booms, super tankers. Had they just BP just went after it 100% with all of these huge oil pickup vessels, this A whale now that you're hearing about, three football fields long, the A whale. I mean, they're experimenting with that thing now out there. But these boats, these vessels should have been out there 70 days ago. Okay? I mean, why did they wait? Why did they let it fester? And then, and of course, the dispersants. A lot of people now are saying if they let the oil go to the surface, they could have captured it. The Europeans, the Dutch, all of the experts are saying, we don't use dispersants. We capture our oil with skimmers. Why did BP choose to use these dispersants? And now this stuff is sinking. It's in 5,000 feet of water. It's washing up on the Mississippi coast at this time, which is very shallow. I mean, you literally have a huge sand wall about 20 miles off the Mississippi Gulf coast. It's extremely shallow. Then you have this huge canyon. It just drops off to 5,000 feet from an average depth of about 35 feet to 5,000 feet. So we're going to have this huge deposit of oil in the water column for years, huge vortex of oil circling around that deep water 50 miles off the Mississippi coast for years. And every time you have a hurricane or a tropical storm or any kind of weather event, it's going to lift that stuff up with the tides and the currents. It's going to bring it right to us. Or if it doesn't come to us, it's going to go to Florida. And God knows, if they don't stop it, this stuff is going to be going, you know, in those currents going through, going eastward toward the Keys, possibly impact Cuba. I mean, It's horrible. It's
Cuba,
a nightmare.
The Caribbean, getting into that, what they call the loop, into the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
This is a hole in the world, really. It's considered the worst environmental disaster of our time. And I'm sorry that you're on the front line. We're speaking with Captain Lewis Scrametta. He is chief executive of the Ship Island Excursions in Gulfport. He's horrified, as all of us are, as we watch what's going on. You said, as we were preparing for this, I spoke with you this morning before we went on the air, and you said, I believe it was something like, this is sort of like being in remission with cancer after we dealt with Katrina, and now here it comes back full force, and it's threatening your life.
Absolutely. We just went through five horrible years of the worst natural disaster in recent times. And the Mississippi Gulf Coast was wiped out. Homes built before the Civil War that went through 50 hurricanes, destroyed in August 05, 2005. I mean, I live on the beach, and I tell you, I feel like I live in a city park. I'm one of the few houses that were able to rebuild after the storm, and I'm surrounded by these beautiful groves of live oaks. It's like living in a city park. I'm walking my dog right now through these oaks, and they love it. And all of these spots, these home sites where these huge homes stood for years and years, and they're still gone. I don't think anybody's ever going to build back because of insurance and other factors. And now, the coast was coming back to a certain degree. I mean, they rebuilt the roads, hotels were being rebuilt, restaurants were reopening, tourism was coming back. It was a wonderful feeling. We had one of the best springs in recent memory on our boats. We had a 70% increase on hits to our website over the month of March and April. People were calling and inquiring about our new schedule for 2010. And very optimistic. Everybody was just feeling really upbeat and good for the first time in 5 years. And then this thing hits on April 20th. And let me tell you, it was devastating, and it's still devastating. The anxiety level of people that live down here, I don't know how to describe it. It's like I mentioned to you, I compared it to getting rid of a cancer and then having it show up again. You know, and it's now this time we think it's deadly, because I really feel in my heart that this is going to change our way of life down here forever. I don't think it will ever be the same. It's destroyed our seafood industry, and that's the backbone of our tourism industry and our general quality of life in this region. Mississippi can't compete with the beautiful beaches of Destin, Florida, and Pensacola. I mean, they have incredible beaches over there, and the tourism of Florida is phenomenal. One thing we do have here in Mississippi is wonderful seafood. We've got the best oysters in the world here at Past Christian, Mississippi. We've got the sweetest Gulf shrimp, wonderful shrimp. They still have them. They haven't wiped it out yet. We had them until the state and the federal government shut down all fishing in the Mississippi Sound. In fact, fishing from the mouth of the river all the way around to Pensacola, Florida, is outlawed. You cannot fish, and you can fish, but you can't keep the fish. You can't shrimp. They'll make you throw your fish back overboard if they find them. So, I mean, you think about that. If we don't have seafood here, what's our future here? You have legalized gaming. That's been a big part of our economy here in Mississippi. But now everybody has gaming. All the states are opening up casinos. So, I mean, it's just one of these things that we wonder about our future here. And quite frankly, I really feel like leaving for the first time. I mean, I thought we really had something special here, and it's just been destroyed.
Well,
really,
our hearts go out. We're speaking with Captain Lewis Scrametta. He is talking to us from Gulfport, Mississippi, on the coast, right on the beach. And Mississippi was the last of the Gulf states to get hit by this toxic oil combination, whatever you want to call it. Finally, and I know this is probably a bit of a touchy subject, but I think it's really important that we talk about it. We talked about the destruction of the environment. We talked about the devastation to the sea life and the birds suffering. But let me ask you, I keep remembering Jaws. And if I'm not mistaken, the big debate at the beginning of the film, after there was fear of sharks, is did they close the beach or did they leave it open? The commerce and the industry and the people who make their money off the ocean and the beach were wanting to keep it open. essentially putting people at risk. Others said, no, we have to close the beach. I understand mm-hmm. for the 4th of July weekend, the beaches were open. I guess there were people swimming in the water. There was also oil swimming in the water. Can you mm-hmm. talk about that?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm going to tell you, this 4th of July Sunday, I would normally have had about 1,200 passengers on my boat for that day. We sell out. That's one of the big days when we just turn people away. 1,200 is our limit in one day that we bring to the island. We had 54 people on the boat Sunday. First time in, you know, what, 80-something years that we've been operating that we had that low a turnout on our boat. It was the whole tourism industry along the coast. If you're affiliated with water activities, you know, charter boats and jet ski rentals and these types of activities, beach rentals, are all suffering. But yeah, our governor, as you know, has been promoting tourism down here. BP gave the state of Mississippi, our governor, $15 million to promote the state of Mississippi, and they've been trying to get people to come here. Yeah, and they still have seafood. They still have, the restaurants are still open. I was in a seafood restaurant last night, and I was able to order a beautiful flounder, beautifully prepared flounder, which is a popular fish here. But they didn't have any oysters, no oysters, zip, nothing. And the owner of the restaurant, who's a friend of mine, said they can't get them any longer. But they're doing what they can.
But back to that health issue, I've heard up and down the coast that people exposed in one way or another have had mm-hmm. some serious reactions. I'm asking if you observed people swimming in the water, the same waters that are being fouled by the oil.
I can tell you this, when our passengers ask us, when they go to the island, we have a little statement that we read that they can read before they board the boat, letting them know about the oil. It's prepared by the National Park Service. But we tell them, if I were you, I would not swim in the water. That's what we tell our people. And I can tell you, I know not to get in this water. I would not do it. And the people that are telling you to get in the water are wrong. The head of the EPA last week, she was in Pensacola. She said she wouldn't get in the water.
All right. And how's your family doing? How are you doing? When I talk to people, I also hear that, you know, when you have your life turned upside down like this, when you have your income cut, when you lose your daily life, it destroys homes, it destroys families, it creates violence. Yeah. There's more, you know, spousal abuse. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I'm sure that, as I mentioned earlier, the anxiety level down here is incredible. I have two sons, one just finished college and one about to finish. He can't find a job. It's very difficult right now to find any employment down here unless you work for BP. And who knows how long that's going to last. And that's not very healthy either, by the way. We didn't talk about these people that are out there picking up this oil and shoveling this oil. I mean, my God, I wouldn't do it. I'm just telling you this, that yes, it's getting worse and worse. A lot of people, everybody I talk to is just, you know, depressed. They want to talk about this to me like I can help them, because they know I've been very vocal about this all along and tried to warn local officials to get ready for it, prepare for it, and they just sat back. You have Governor Haley Barbour and Congressman Gene Taylor, and they were downplaying it and said the environmentalists were scaring everybody and causing panic. There's nothing to worry about. They assured everybody that everything was fine, and now look what they're doing. They're running around the last minute trying to get bills skimmers now, and you know they're angry at the federal government and blaming President Obama. It's his fault. You know, I mean, it's just not a good place to be right now. I mean, I'm telling you, living on the Mississippi Gulf Coast is just not a good place.
Noticed that Governor Barbour said that recently that it would be the worst nightmare of all would be to stop drilling.
Yeah, can you imagine making a statement like that?
That would be worse than the disaster to not drill.
Yeah, can you imagine? This is our leadership down here. And this is somebody from Yazoo City, Mississippi, that's probably never been to Ship Island. unless he was on a helicopter at Horn Island, you know, one of his photo ops, and could care less. He's pro-oil, and every time you turn around, he's an apologist for BP. It's been horrible. That's what we're dealing with. And by the way, he's head of the DEQ. He's a relative of his is the head of the DEQ. He appointed her, and he calls the shots. If one of his cronies wants a development plan in Mississippi, they get it done. Big Haley's going to get it done for him. Several years ago.
You're saying the DEQ? What are you saying?
Yeah.
What's that?
I'm telling you that Haley Barbour has so much power in the state. He appoints the head of the Department of Environmental Quality for Mississippi. Okay? The person in charge is a relative of his. A very close friend relative. And Haley, if you want your permit, if you want to build a chemical plant or if you want to open up a coal burning plant in the state of Mississippi, you got it. Haley's going to be your cheerleader. I mean, he's with you. And this is what he actually tried to in 05 wanted to start drilling in the Mississippi Sound right off of our beach here, and we fought him. We fought him back in 05, warning about, you know, the reasons why we don't want oil rigs, oil and gas exploration near our beaches. And I'm telling you, this man is for the oil companies. He's lobbying for chemical companies and he's got the biggest lobby firm in Washington on K Street that handles big oil, big tobacco, and it's unfortunate. 60-plus days of doing nothing. We've got the smallest coastline and had the longest time to prepare for it, and they haven't done a damn thing.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there for now, Captain Louis Scrametta. We're going to stay with you, though. We're going to watch what goes on. We appreciate the suffering. We understand something of the tragedy that you all are facing down there. We've been speaking with Captain Louis Scrametta. He is chief executive of Ship Island Excursions in Gulfport. He grew up at the Gulf and on the Gulf. The tragedy continues, and no end in sight. We will be back to you soon, sir. Thanks for speaking with us on Flashpoints.
Okay. Thank you for your interest, and hopefully we'll talk with you soon.
Next up on the Best of Flashpoints, on July 8th, the verdict in the case against former transit officer Johannes Meserle, who shot Oscar Grant in the back, was officially announced, and soon after, Flashpoints went live on the air to report on the community's reaction in the streets of Oakland and outside the courthouse in Los Angeles.
We've got a lot of information, a lot of people here to talk with you. We're going to get reports from downtown Oakland, but let's go to Attorney John Burris.
John Burris, attorney for the family. John Burris, attorney for the family. As you can imagine, we are extremely disappointed with this verdict. The verdict is not a true representative of what happened to Oscar Grant and what the officer did to him that night. This is not a voluntary manslaughter case. This is a true compromise verdict that does not truly and accurately reflect the facts. And we are extraordinarily disappointed at that. We do believe that this was a murder case, a second-degree murder. We are surprised that the jury came back as quickly as they did and seemed to be very dismissive of the murder charge and the voluntary manslaughter. Now, of course, we feel that the involuntary manslaughter conviction than no conviction at all. We do recognize and appreciate that there probably is some historical significance that I, in my long history, been involved in police matters since 1979 and well over 30 homicides involving the police, I've never had a case where an officer was convicted of any crime against an African-American male. So in that sense, it's a small victory. But it does not, in and of itself, fairly and accurately represent that the system works. But it cannot work in a situation where a person is killed with his hands behind his back, with an officer over him, claiming that he's seen something, and that becomes particularly when there was no statements made ever within the first several days of this shooting, where the officer claims that, in fact, it was a mistake. In fact, all of his conduct at the outset clearly indicated that he thought he was intending to do what he did. And so for the life of me, I cannot understand and accept that this is an involuntary manslaughter, which essentially means it was a negligent act. So in that sense, the family is extraordinarily unhappy about what has happened here. It is not a true reflection of how the criminal justice system ought to work. We recognize, as African Americans, that the system is rarely fair when police officers are involved in shooting African American males. This is another example of it, albeit not on the same level as when no charges are filed and no conviction is had. So in that sense, it's a very small step forward, but in many ways it's a step backwards as well, because no true justice has been given. The next test, of course, is when and how much time the officer, Mr. Messerly, is sentenced to jail. Under traditional, regular notions, he should be going to jail for the rest of his life. So the rest of his life. But yet, he very well may get a sentence that does not even require him to go to jail, which would be the ultimate insult and travesty, as I can imagine. But notwithstanding that, all I can say is this has been a long haul for the family. Just that nightmarish night of January 1, early morning hours, when Miss Johnson and the rest of the family and the boys who were on the platform all had to see Oscar Grant die. And we have been vigilant. There's been a lot of supporters, not only here, but in Oakland and around the country. All have seen the video and understand the tragedy that's taken place. And we certainly appreciate all of the support that they have given us. And I will say again, we do not want anyone to be injured, to be hurt, property destroyed, or lives lost as a consequence of this verdict. One death is enough. We do not accept the verdict. We do not like the verdict. But we do not want anyone else to die or to be injured or property be lost as a consequence of this.
John Burris, ungagged, down in L.A. in front of the courtroom after the verdict. He represents the family, the Grant family, on the civil side. And like I say, let me just let people know who are listening on the Flashpoint side of the network. This is a special. We're here broadcasting from Oakland and Berkeley in California. The Johannes Messerly trial was announced in L.A. It was involuntary manslaughter, the least of three charges that he could have been convicted of under the instructions of the jury. And we're going to devote the entire hour to that verdict. In one moment, we're going to be joined again by Jaron the Block Report. We're going to be talking with Keisha Brunston. But first, Davey, John Burris ungagged. We know why he was gagged, huh?
Yes. Burris, for a long time, has walked many of us through these cases and given us a sense of direction, where it was going, his legal expertise. And to not have him left us at the complete mercy of media that was spinning this every which way with no counterspin that could be respected, at least in a mainstream sense. So I thought that was problematic. And I look at this in the same vein as the clamping and the gagging that's going on right now with the BP oil spill and other types of situations that are now becoming the norm. That, you know, you have a newsworthy event and now people are saying with conviction that you can be gagged. And I think JR mentioned earlier about this trend to now eliminate and make it illegal for you to film officers unless you're violating, I think, obstruction of justice laws, the Patriot Act, which we forgot about, you know, as well as some of the things in Homeland Security. So this is a trend that's going on, and I think we definitely need to be awakened to this. And the fact that Burris, who wasn't even in this trial, could not speak as an expert, speaks volumes.
This is the Minister of Information, J.R., Block Report Radio, reporting on the Flashpoints Hard Knock Radio special, talking about the Johannes Messerli verdict, which was involuntary manslaughter. Next, we have on the line, live from Los Angeles, Keisha Brunston, whose nephew in 2003, DeAndre Brunston, was a victim of Compton police, the victim of a Compton police murder, and she has been somebody who has been accompanying the Oscar Grant family in Los Angeles. Keisha, are you there?
Yes.
Keisha, can you tell us a little bit about how do you feel being the victim and your family being the victim of police murder in the Los Angeles area, that being the murder of DeAndre Brunston in 2003? And as Davey talked a little bit about a media blackout or media whiteout on the DeAndre Brunston, because there was also a film, there was film of DeAndre being killed, but it didn't take off like the Oscar Grant case did. But still, yet and still, with the Oscar Grant case taking off, we still only got an involuntary manslaughter verdict. So how do you feel about those two questions?
First of all, about the verdict, I'm trying to figure out why we can't get no justice, because this was still, we didn't get no justice today in the courtroom. We didn't get no justice for the Oscar Grant family, for DeAndre, for Baby Susie, all the stolen lives. We got no justice today in the courtroom.
Well, just to recap, I want to tell people, look it up on YouTube. You can see the murder of DeAndre Brunston. And DeAndre Brunston was shot over 80 times by Compton police officers in Compton, California. That was in 2003, where they accidentally shot their dog and helicoptered the dog and watched DeAndre die. Right there, you can see the footage right there on the right there on YouTube.
That's also, remember, while they was killing DeAndre, they had kidnapped and beat me.
That's right.
That's interesting that you mentioned that they did this to the dog, because they did this similar thing in Pittsburgh. And it's almost like that's being done to make a point. Like, your life isn't worth more than this dog.
Right.
They let a brother die in Pittsburgh while they went and, you know, helped the dog, you know,
right.
And the guy didn't do nothing, you know. So this is something else going on.
Okay, we got Ghetto Prophet live from 14th and Broadway. He's a spoken word artist in Oakland, and he was also in the street, I mean, also in the court. Room in Los Angeles. Ghetto Prophet, are you there?
What's up with it, bro?
Hey, can you tell us what is going on in 14th and Broadway right now?
This is in Oakland, California, right?
Yes, we're in Oakland.
There's an attempted takeover of the 14th and Broadway intersection going on right now. Basically, it's just going to be us for a minute, man. We're going to just put the speakers out here. The armored tanks.
Watch yourself.
Armored tanks sliding through this thing. Got into seen like four helicopters. So, you know, we definitely occupied at the moment, but it's good. Like, they, I mean, you know, we out here, though.
How many people would you say are at the protest in Oakland?
Right now, honestly, it's probably about, I say maybe a couple hundred, if that. But it's still people coming, too, so.
How many police would you say are out there?
Whew. Now that. Honestly, I'm going to tell you the truth, though. Real, right now, you don't see as many right where we at. They all on the outskirts right now.
What kind of equipment?
You see them moving through. So, like, say we on 14th and Broadway.
Yes.
Where you at?
All right, my bad. You get to, when you get to, like, 12 over in that area, like, Jefferson area, they got all that heavily blocked off. And so... But they pretty much letting us have 14th and Broadway for right now, so we're going to see how long this lasts.
Ghetto Prophet, can you give the phone to somebody who might be next to you so we can get a myriad of voices right there from the front lines of 14th and Broadway?
I got Danae right here with me, another one of the comrades been rocking with us.
Okay, let me talk to her.
Hello, Danae.
Yes. Hello?
Yeah, Danae, watch your language because we're live on the radio, but can you tell us what is it that you're experiencing right there at the 14th and Broadway BART station?
It's a lot of anger, but people are just trying to hold their composure because we don't want no more killing. We don't want no more violence. That's not what Oscar Grandmom wants. She don't want nobody else getting killed. But a lot of people are upset out here. We really upset. We hurt. We're just trying to find a way to just stay calm. Any type of way, we just want to scream and holler.
All right, I want to thank you. This is Dennis Bernstein here with JR.
OPD is about to set this intersection down right here on 14th and Broadway. They're going to shut it down. It's ours. We can scream and holler all we want to. Just don't break nothing. Don't hurt nobody. That's all we want.
Well, there you have it. They were talking to Danae, I believe, out on 14th and Broadway. That's the town square this afternoon and this evening. We're telling people to go down there. And I agree what one of our other callers said. This is not the time to be hiding in the house, turning on Fox and CNN and getting the spin. This is the time that we have to uphold each other. This is the time that young ones need to talk to elders and vice versa. And we need to collectively come up with solutions and support and heal one another. I think people underestimate how much of a shock and trauma this is. It was a trauma starting with the writers. It continued with Oscar Grant. And then we went through this whole situation. And now we have this disappointment after, you know, folks like yourselves did everything. Dotted the I's, crossed the T's, organized, did the whole nine just to have this result. This is trauma and this needs healing.
Well, the question is, can there be healing without justice? And, you know, without a murder conviction, it truly is really not justice.
I agree 100%. I agree 100%.
Let's bring in Julianne Hing. She's a reporter with Color Lines magazine. She's in Oakland watching things unfold. Let me tell you, if you're a regular listener to Flashpoints, this is a special a collaboration between Flashpoints and Hard Knock Radio. We are responding to the verdict of Johannes Mescherle, who murdered Oscar Grant at close range, shot him, says he pulled the wrong gun, and he was given involuntary manslaughter. He could serve between 5 and 12 years, many people feel that this guy was let off almost scot-free. Julianne Hing, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon.
All right, why don't you give us a sense of what's going on in downtown Oakland, California, where Oscar Grant was cut down and lost his young life.
In Oakland right now, the streets outside of 14th, beyond 14th and Broadway, where most people are assembling, are fairly deserted. The major highways outside of leading out of town are pretty packed. There has been mandatory evacuations ordered for government employees in the neighborhood. So the city is pretty quiet right now, but my colleagues have told me that there are also people already on the move. Folks at 14th and Broadway are beginning to march now. And so far it's been very peaceful, but there are several hundred people already gathered.
What do you think are the multiple implications of this kind of jury in the face of so much evidence and this history of a violent cop?
As someone who was inside the courtroom for most of this trial, I can tell you that the verdict today, while so disappointing and while very, very outrageous, was, if you look at the history of the track record that this country has of trying to convict police officers who have shot especially young black and brown men, it's a pretty poor track record. And so this verdict today, while really disappointing, was in several ways not shocking, especially considering how short a time the jury actually deliberated. You know, the jury actually got a new juror yesterday morning and then adjourned for the day at 11:45 because the juror had a doctor's appointment, and then they reconvened today this morning. So all in all, they had less than a full day of deliberations before they came to their verdict.
And they had a lot of information if they really wanted to consider it, and a lot of evidence if they wanted to look into it. You are listening to a special Hard Knock Radio and Flashpoints.
Yeah, David. Hello? D. Caller, you're on the air. Who's this we're talking to?
Yes, This is Brian Shum from the Lenny College Black Student Union. We right here in the thick of it right now, 14th and Broadway. We just took this over, man. We're not taking no more injustice against our people, man. It was a slap in the face, the verdict that they came out.
All right, Jabari, slow down. Jabari, slow down. Tell us a little bit about what is going on. You just told us that you took over 14th and Broadway. How many people and what exactly is the sentiment of the people that are taking it over?
A man, it's 400-500 people out here at least. I'm on the radio. It's 400-500 people out here at least, man. We all upset, man, and we all seeking for justice right now.
So you guys are, you've taken over 14th and Broadway with the 400-500 people?
Yes, we right in the middle of it. They call in the police right now. I hear sirens and helicopters everywhere. Man, it's everybody out here. It's not just black folks searching for justice for Officer Grant. It's white people. It's Asians. I mean, I can't tell some of the races of the people out here. It's a mixed minority.
Well, let me ask you real quick, because I know you were somebody who was in court and wrongfully thrown out of court during Messerly's testimony in Los Angeles last week or a week and a half ago. What is justice? What is justice in your opinion?
Justice is a federal indictment against the Bart, a federal investigation against Bart, Johannes Messerly, and the police department. Justice is for them to disclose or get rid of the whole police bill of rights. That's justice. That where an officer kills a man, then an officer has to stand trial, just like I would have to stand trial. If I was to kill somebody and my friends were standing around, they would be on trial for accessory to murder. That's justice to us. Tony Peroni going to jail. Dominici going to jail. That's justice for us.
Those are two of the other police officers that were with Messerly when he killed Oscar Grant on the platform. So the people out there would like to see an indictment of these other two police officers at least. Is that what you're saying?
At least, and an indictment of Bart for the whole cover-up of this whole situation and to see why we couldn't get evidence put in the court that we had. They hid evidence.
All right, well, thank you, Jabari. Thank you for being with us right there in the streets, 14th and Broadway. And we're going to be going to Jamila King of Color Lines.
Jamila, you're on the air with us. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. What's going on down there? How are you feeling?
Right now, it just actually escalated a little bit. People are marching down the street, about 100 people, maybe a little bit less. Police are getting a lot more aggressive. They're marching to meet protesters on Broadway near 13th.
When you say aggressive, what do you mean by aggressive?
So you have police who have tried to drive, I don't know what they are, sort of like mini little SUV-type vehicles to block protesters off. They're coming up really quickly on Broadway. They're flashing their lights. They're telling people to stay on the sidewalk.
Jamila, hold on 1 second. JR, we have special guests, I think.
We have Jack Bryson, live from Los Angeles. His two sons were with Oscar Grant when Oscar Grant was murdered, and he was also in the courtroom when the verdict was read. Jack Bryson?
What's going on, JR?
Hey, can you tell us a little bit, how do you feel? Your two sons are involved in this. You knew Oscar Grant personally. How do you feel about the involuntary manslaughter verdict that was given to Johannes Messerly in the murder of Oscar Grant?
I'm not feeling that at all. It's not good. It's all bad, you know. It's not bad, you know. I'm thinking about while I was in there, the thoughts that came across my mind was Sean Bell. You know what I'm saying? Is this going to be the same thing that happened to Sean Bell? You know?
What is it that the family would like to see, you know, at this particular point? Now that Messerly has involuntary manslaughter, supposedly with an enhancement, a firearm enhancement, are you guys pushing to get Dominici and Peroni indicted for at least perjury, but also possibly murder or accessory to murder?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I was saying to the room. You know, that I hope that Ron Bellum does the right thing and contact the Department of Justice, because every police officer that testified in Johannes Messerly's behalf committed perjury.
That's definitely true. Yeah.
You know, and perjury, you got Marion Jones, you got Lil' Kim, who went to prison. Federal prison. So this is a murder case, and that was for sure. So I hope Mr. Bellum does the right thing and contacts the Department of Justice.
What is there anything that you would want people who are listening right now to do to help with whatever you all are going through, or, you know, just to help in terms of getting justice even further?
Yeah, to contact, do what you can to contact the Department of Justice. just write letters, emails, whatever you can do to let the Department of Justice know this wasn't fair.
Mr. Bryson, this is Dennis Bernstein here with Davey D and JR. I want to ask you what you think the ramifications are for young people when they see this kind of injustice based on so much evidence. What do you worry about?
The youngsters are going to have that I don't give a F attitude. And the system has that I don't give a F attitude right back.
No doubt. Well, thank you, Jack, for being with us. Can you stay right but there by your phone? We might need to contact you again. And so we'll talk to you soon, Jack.
Coming up right now, we have Cephas Johnson. That is the uncle of Oscar Grant. Cephas, you are with us. We've seen you commenting usually at the end of the proceedings each night. What is going on to your mind right now?
We as a family are very disappointed. We did not expect the jury to come back with the verdict so quickly. So in that regard, we're very thankful, and we really are certain if the jury really took a look at all the evidence that was presented in this case.
Why do you think they didn't take a look? Were there a noticeable bias that you could pick up when you saw the jurors, or was there something else at play?
There was many things at play before the jurors even really got the case. Issues with what I consider evidence being allowed in, issues with the judge and the instructions given to the jurors from the judges for the jury's instruction. So there were many elements besides the jury that was at play that have always gave the inference that we're not really just in a case, but we really are fighting a system.
Now that tear gas is being shot in Oakland, I mean, what do you think about Oakland's response to Oscar Grant? I can understand. I would only overstand that you as the family are devastated by the fact that he did not get a murder charge. I mean, what do you think about the people in Oakland?
Well, I'm totally unaware of what's happening in Oakland. You know, right now my main concern is the embracing of my family. Us dealing with the impact that it has had on us as a family, the struggles that we've been through the past 19 months and getting to this point. As far as the community, it is my hope that the community, a coalition of activists that I know that has been with us, supported us, embraced us, continue to utilize the First Amendment right to speak to the injustice and police brutality that has occurred in our community. We've always stood as a nonviolent, destructive family, and the coalition of activists that are still with us also has stood in that same manner. So it is my belief, and of course my hope, that the people of Oakland continue to stand and utilize the First Amendment right in a non-destructive way.
Uncle Bobby, can you tell us a little bit how your sister, Wanda Johnson, the mother of Oscar Grant, is taking this?
She's very, very hurt. Very, very disappointed. Breathless. And in pain. But at the same time, we haven't given up, and she hasn't given up hope. Because we know that there's a higher justice that Johannes Mesley must answer to. And we know justice will come. It may not come in the
Well, thank you, Uncle Bobby, for being with us. That was Cephas, Uncle Bobby Johnson, the uncle of Oscar Grant. That was live from Los Angeles. He is there with his sister, Wanda Johnson, who is also the mother of Oscar Grant.
I draw a lot of strength from them. I can only imagine what they're going through, having walked this journey, and keeping in mind that they lost their son, and had to see him demonized even before the body was cold. If you remember, the police leaked out that information and had his track record running all over the place. And so just seeing how they managed to stay is incredible. We're hearing reports of tear gas being shot at people in downtown Oakland. Jamila King from Color Lines, are you hearing or seeing anything like that?
Seen that yet. Right now I'm on 11th and Broadway, and police are stopping people from going further down Broadway. There's a crowd of about 100 people toward this side of Broadway, and there's also another crowd for the candlelight vigil on 14th and Broadway. So I haven't seen tear gas being shot.
So they are not letting anybody go towards the 14th and Broadway meeting place?
No, they are. They're not letting anyone go down Broadway past 11th, so they're not letting anybody go to 10th. They're keeping people contained in this area of Broadway.
When you say
police on all sides.
Oh, so they're police on all sides. Do you see them using any sort of crowd control methods? Do they have machinery, horses, barricades, or anything like that?
Those movable gates?
They have barricades. They have a bunch of police vehicles out here. Police are here in SWAT gear. People are here in masks. They have their batons out. They're in fighting position.
Are there different police departments that have joined in with BART and Oakland? Are there federal police, state police? Because I understand that the various police departments from all over the state have been having meetings about supporting the cops of Oakland.
Right now, I'm looking at OPD on 11th and Broadway. There are definitely Alameda County Sheriffs here. I have not seen any other police forces here.
Okay. One of the things I do want to let people know that the National Lawyers Guild is out there. They are doing observance and gave out a phone number, 415-285-1011. So just keep that in mind. 415-285-1011 is a number that you can also keep in mind. What do you think people should be doing at this point, Jamila?
Okay, an armored truck just came down, 11th Street, so and police are marching.
See, that's the kind of vehicle, by the way, that you get from national security participation.
Yes. Right.
These
so
tanks.
Definitely here in force.
And now,
in terms of what people should do, people are still rallying peacefully at the end of the block. But right now, I think that people should just keep the family in their wishes. People should, if they're out here, be safe. If they're not, just, get the word out and let people know that this is happening.
I wanted to ask you, JR, you mentioned that, we can't heal without, justice here. What do you think the next step should be? We often debate about whether you can trust this system, and it looks like, a lot of your comments and thoughts are being underscored today.
I definitely agree. I think we have to go forward at this point. I think that I agree with a lot of the things that the callers are saying. There needs to be a further investigation into this, maybe on a federal level. Not that I think that they're actually going to do something, but that it can be exposed so that the people can push for this mediocrity of justice that we have at this particular point that we wouldn't have had the people not rebelled the first time in the streets. So, at this point, we were hoping for a murder conviction, because that is definitely what it is. It is a murder. It is not an involuntary. It is not an involuntary manslaughter, But we understand that the pressure of the people is the only way they got this far. So I think that the people should call for Peroni's indictment, Domenici's indictment. We should look into perjury charges. We should go against the, the police bill of rights.
Yeah.
We need to look into destroying that.
Well, there is, and there is a law. You talk about the Police Bill of Rights, but there's also supposed to be enhanced punishment for cops who commit crimes behind the shield. That's written into the law, too. It's like a hate crime.
Well, that's where you definitely have these conflicts of interest when you have a prosecutor that has to answer to the police later on. That's why you have to have a special prosecutor that is completely disconnected from that. And, and one that's not politicized, not appointed, none of that, but there's another way in which they're able to do their job.
And I think just to add on to Dennis talking about the hate crime, we have to also remember that hate crime language was used in this case on not one occasion but three occasions, where his superior, Tony Peroni, on the platform called Oscar Grant a bitch ass nigger.
Wow. Well, and that's something. What's crazy about that, and we talked about this, more people were talking about Mel Gibson using that word than these police officers.
That wraps it up for the Best of Flashpoints. Thanks for listening.